And some of them will do the little by little by little, back up, more little by little, and they will begin to develop that sense of trust. The sixth category in complex trauma is what we call somatization. It's a relatively new area in working with trauma, so there isn't all that much about it. But it simply means that somebody has recurring medical symptoms without a discernible organic cause. So I had a patient years ago who had a history of all kinds of pain between her waist and her knees. Well, they took just about everything out of her that they could find. Everything out of her was healthy, but the doctors didn't know what to do, so they just kept taking stuff out. The other thing is that the research has shown that women with chronic abuse histories have a high incidence of autoimmune disorders. Now, because I've done this work for so long, I remember back at the beginning, you know, people coming in with these sort of vague symptoms and everybody, you know, the medical community said they're nuts. Now, there's much more respect and understanding for autoimmune disorders, which for anybody who has one, you can be really grateful about that. But you can imagine somebody comes in with terrible fatigue or various other symptoms and goes to the doctor and says, there's nothing wrong with you. I can't find anything wrong with you. It's here. Well, sort of. But what it does is the chronic exposure to stress compromises the stress response system in the body. It's not meant to be on alert all the time. We can't live like that. And then the capacity that we develop in normal environments to evaluate what's happening and verbal memory and information processing and all those things, they can't do it. They have overactive nervous systems. I'm sure you've seen many occasions of the exaggerated startle response. That's part of what that is. Chemicals released in the body result in constant anxiety, hyperarousal, and difficulty sleeping, all of which have tremendous effect on health, particularly if it goes on for decades. The final category involves despair, hopelessness, meaning of life stuff, if there was belief, loss of belief. If there wasn't belief, sometimes it's the loss of hope that there's someone to believe in. If great difficulty making sense out of life, and find the God who allows such things on this planet, very confusing at best and evil at worst. Makes sense. And so the other possibility is they just reject faith and reject God. The other possibility is they throw themselves into faith without processing anything of what happened. And they just use that faith just like they use self-injury. It is a drug to be fine and a wall to keep the memories at bay. And it's very important to understand that because it is faith without truth, which is no faith at all. And we in the Christian community want people to have faith in God. And so we hear faith language and all that stuff and we... I'm going to keep doing this. It won't work. We encourage that language and we respond positively and we welcome it. Be careful. It can be just as much a tool as cutting. You need time to watch and listen, because if it's true faith, they'll want truth. And if it's true faith, character will change. So I'm going to show you a few pictures. I want to just tell you three things first. One is, words describing these situations are ridiculously inadequate. So we need to keep that in mind when we work with people. Two, I have found that both in my work with my patients in the office, but also in my work around the world, the trauma story is never told as a linear narrative. I was born, my daddy burnt my feet, then this happened. It doesn't come out like that, ever. And if it does, something else is going on. First of all, it's not all in there like a narrative. When Ground Zero happened, I was asked to go up like 3 weeks later to work with the men in the pit, the firemen and all that. The ground was still hot. It was quite an experience. But I met a woman who was there, of course, the day the towers fell. And she wanted to tell me her story. And it was like 3 weeks later. And I thought, okay, and let's see what she does. And so she said, basically like this, you know, I got up in the morning and I had breakfast and told my husband goodbye and my kids went to school and I got on the subway and I came to the towers. And then she stopped and she said, I saw the color of their ties. I saw the color of their ties over and over and over and over again. She lost her linear narrative because she was outside watching people jump out of the windows, and the only thing she remembered was the color of their ties. That's what it's like. You can't say, I got off the subway, I went to work, I typed three papers, and then we had to go outside, and then these people were jumping, and the, you know, you can't do that. The body and the mind can't do that. They can't absorb the whole thing. So three, though words must eventually be used to convey the story and for us to respond to it, they are not sufficient. Not only are they impossible, I mean, how do you describe the life that I started out with words? How do you describe the atrocity of a genocide with words? It can't be done, but you have to say something. They're inadequate for getting to truth. They're inadequate to get the truth of God or the dignity of personhood or the love that you want to get into a trafficked soul. You cannot talk it there. And that's a very important thing for you to know, not just for your work, but for churches that get involved. They want to come and they want to talk it there. They want to say, honey, God loves you and it's going to be all right. It does what I say, splat, and falls off. It doesn't go in. You can say it soft, you can say it loud, you can say it 100 times. It won't go in. And not only that, she can tell you in a dead certain way, right, I know this, I'm trash, and if you hang around long enough, you'll see that I'm right. It won't go in. Now, part of the problem is her cognitive functioning, which if she's been marinated in abuse all of her life, it impairs the frontal cortex. It's affected by repeated trauma, especially prior to the age of 24. She can't think because she can't think. It has nothing to do with intelligence. She can IQ of 140, and she can't think. You think about it this way. Suppose you're driving to work one day, and you're coming up on a busy intersection, and the light turns, and the guy in front of you starts to go, and then he stops, and you slam into him, and your car's a mess and totaled. And you think how your body would feel. You're shaking, you're worried, you want to know if you're hurt. There's all kinds of things. And suppose I came along at the moment, and I opened the side door of your car, and I got in and said, you know, I thought today would be a good day for a philosophy lesson. What are you going to do? You can't follow anything I'm saying. That's how she feels all the time. She feels like she was just in a car wreck. So what do? Well, we have to find ways of entry and expression that are nonverbal or partially verbal. So my patients use a lot of things like art and drawings and painting and music and sculpture and dance or story, not hers, made up story. Years ago, I had a ballerina as a client who had been chronically abused in her childhood by her grandfather, and she kept trying to tell me the story. She couldn't do it. She would say a few things, and then she would retreat, and then anyway. Finally, I said to her, I have a homework assignment for you. I want you to go home, and between now and next week, I want you to create a ballet that tells your story. So she did. She went, and when she came back the next week, I don't really have that big of an office, but when she came back the next week, she danced for me. And the end, she had hair down to here, the end of the thing was to curl herself up in a fetal position and take her hair and pull it all over her till she was covered. And I understood her story. But it was her first approach to story. And then she could go back, not tell the story, but talk about the dance. So it's once removed. People can do that with paintings. They can do it with all kinds of things. So just as you can introduce things like yoga or aerobic exercise or whatever to deal with the agitation, so you can use nonverbal expression to help her tell her story and how it has shaped her and how she carries it. So the pictures that I want to show you are one of the ways that somebody who came to see me helped me understand what it felt like inside her. They're simply random pictures from the internet. She would type in a word that she thought was what she felt and look on the internet until she found an image that expressed it. So I'm just going to show you 8 of those because I want you to get into her experience because it will help you get into others. Okay, look at this picture. That's her as a little girl. I mean, not really. Look at the swing. First of all, it's way too high. And second of all, it's not tied to anything. That's what she felt like all of her growing up. She's doing a little girl thing that's supposed to be wonderful, and it's hellish. Okay? Look what she's doing here. I am safe, 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 I am safe. The first lie I told. So here she is, a little girl, trying to be safe. And one of the ways she tried was just to say it to her. She would just do it. I'm safe, I'm safe, I'm safe, I'm safe. Well, she wasn't. Now she can say it was the first lie she ever told. People will tell you they feel overwhelmed. And you all have felt overwhelmed. And that's what you think it means. That is overwhelmed. That is a distressing, terrifying, everything unraveling, I can't stop moving picture. That's how she feels. And many of them feel that way 24 hours a day. And you wonder why they can't sleep. Okay. This one is her expression of despair. Now, I've been in the Christian world a really long time. And you know what we want to do when somebody has despair? We want to give them hope. So what we do is we see them like this, and we're standing outside the room. We're not in that room because we don't live there. And we're saying, it's going to be okay. Something good will happen. Somebody will help, or I'll help, or whatever. That's the experience. I'm in the room. The water's rising. There's not even a window for the darn water to leak out. And I can't do anything about it. And you can't either. Okay. I think I have this written down. Let me read it to you. This is the poem that she wrote. That's a little girl with a cello on her back, like a burden. I don't know when exactly the music died. Early on, I suspect. My instrument fell silent and hid. I suppose it felt guilty, guilty to play beauty in my midst. After all, no beauty in me appeared to exist. An instrument made to be played and call me to feel gentle beauty, inviting me to dance and to glide, yet all I could do was cover and hide. Oh, but I played music still. Hideous music inside. I think there's, is there another one? Yes. That's what she's like when she comes to you. This is who you see, and that's who she is. This is not who she sees. Am I in your way? Can you see? You remember, she's in a cage that she can't get out. And she's screaming. Okay. This one is a very, I don't know if you can see, but her hands are all bloody. Overwhelmed, mind confused, history speaking, slitting the skin that protects, making me bleed memory. That's what self-injury is. I think one more. Are you sure it's okay? Are you sure you won't leave me if I come out and do not play blind? You want to know what I know in your life and mind? First, just a peek to see what you do. If you still want to live and how you'll react. You may want me to go back deep down inside, tucked in a corner as if I had died. But if you agree, I too would like to see with your eyes. Part of what she's saying here is, if I see just with my eyes, I go back to mistrust and no hope and all of those other things. And again, if you've raised children, been around little children, have grandchildren, whatever, you see them. They do something, you say, oh, that was a good job, or this or that, or anything else. You're telling them what you see with your eyes, and that's how they develop that sense of self. She hasn't had that. That's why she wants to see with your eyes. Who do you see? And I will caution you, because we want to tend toward hope and healing and all those things, which we should tend toward, but don't ever tell her something you don't really see. She can smell a lie a mile away, and you'll be done. So she needs for you to see her as God created her, and see the truth of the damage done to her, and the hope for this created being to show up as she works on the damage. And she needs to see all of that through your eyes. And you will give her hope, you will build trust, and she will begin to grow for the first time since she was a little girl. Work with those who have experienced complex trauma. Must begin and continue with safety and stabilization as foundational. Now, just to give you a perspective, you have women with you months, a year, 2 years, maybe three, right? When I see these women in my office, I see them more than once a week. I see them for more than an hour at shot. And the ones with the worst complex trauma that I've seen over the years, I've seen for probably about 10 years. That's how long it took. Now, all of that wasn't based on the story and everything else, because you have to learn how to live in the real world once you find out different things about yourself and actually know how to live and grow. But 10 years is a really long time. So you need that perspective, because I think it's very easy to get extremely disappointed because you have them for such a short time and the mountain is so big and you really just got some feet on the mountain and then they're gone. Even if they've done everything they're supposed to do and it's wonderful, it's not all done. So you need to know that that's truth. That's not a failure on your part, or theirs for that matter. But that safety and stabilization phase, which feels repetitive, and it is, long, and it is the foundation. It's the thing that goes back to trust and mistrust with the development stages. And if you don't do that, you can't do anything else. And not only do you have to do it, and I have to do it, and it's there, and you do some work, and the whole thing collapses, and you have to go back and do it again, and again, and again. You're trying to teach a human being how to think and feel and choose and live in a way they didn't even know was a possibility. So, without this, the safety and stabilization, well-intentioned help is easily re-traumatizing, and sometimes just a reenactment of the abuse. Safety and stabilization mean what we call in my field a safe alliance, which is a safe relationship. And that is one of the things that you give to these women. It is often the very first one they've ever had. And what I want you to understand is all of the therapeutic literature, with all of our techniques and all of our kinds of therapy and all of our this's and that's that we say is going to make it all better when you have somebody traumatized, the research has shown without fail that the single most important thing that these victims need is relationship that's safe. And you can do that. You can do that. If she's going to go on and do therapy and all that kind of stuff, she needs that from you before she can even do that. It's the foundation stone. So in the beginning, I assume when she first comes, you're focusing partly on physical safety. She doesn't even know what that is. What you want to give her is as much predictability as possible, which is why you talk about boundaries and all those kinds of things. If this, then that. And again, go back to little ones. If you touch that, mommy will this. I touch that, I look at mommy, and I want to find out if it's predictable. So that's what you're doing. You want to teach them to learn how to self-soothe. You want to teach them how to work with each other over time. That there's actually people that can be part of your life who support what you're doing, who are good for you, and all of those things. All of those things are building blocks for later stages in her life. So even if you have her a year and you see that she probably needs 9 more years of work, she couldn't do the 9 more years if you hadn't given her the year. So it's a time, obviously, with multiple interventions. You do rehab for substance abuse. Sometimes there's eating disorders. Sometimes suicidality is so active that that has to be dealt with before you can do anything else. Self-injury is obviously a problem. But again, it is more coping than it is life-threatening. Go back to the picture of the bleeding memories. So I will often say to patients who self-injure, if that blood could talk, what would it tell me? If that cut could talk, what would it tell me? I mean, obviously, you have to help her manage those things in new ways. You can't revisit the trauma of a life when somebody's actively destroying themselves. You'll just help them destroy themselves quicker. So she cannot progress without a relative degree of safety. So they have to learn that, they have to learn how to receive it, and they have to learn how to create it. Those are two different things. It can take a really long time and has to be revisited over and over again. It's a collaborative effort. She has to partner with you in that at some point. At the beginning, she doesn't know how. But eventually, she has to begin to choose to do for herself what you have showed her to do. So also keep in mind, and you don't need me to tell you this, but expressing things like a desire for her safety can easily result in an angry or sarcastic response. Don't take it personally. It isn't about you. You see, what you're saying is, I want you to learn how to be safe. What you're saying to her is, it's okay to be vulnerable. Well, it isn't okay to be vulnerable. You have terrified her by offering her the very thing she needs the most. And she will pull out every coping mechanism she can feel or find to fight you on it. Education is a part of the safety and stabilization stage. She needs to understand her body. You know, your body feels like that because of this. It's talking to you about that experience. We can actually learn how to do some things. And one of the things, you know, you bring in whatever, yoga and all those kind of things, and aerobic exercise, which is a great thing for being revved up and all that. Don't miss beauty. When I work with these women, you know, they have no sense of beauty, and many of them are unbelievably capable and smart and gifted and all kinds of things they didn't even know. So if somebody's revved up or something, you know, say, come on, let's go for a walk. So you go for the walk, and you walk fast so she can calm herself down and all that stuff, and it's side by side, it's not face to face, so it's less threatening, which is good. But do something unusual on the walk. Pick a flower. And then look at it. You know what this part's called? Look at this color. Take it apart, show her all the pieces, whatever. It's a beautiful thing and it's a gift to both of us. And then pick another one and say, here, keep it. They don't have eyes for the beauty that's in their world. They don't even know it's there. And I have found that to be an amazingly healing thing for many women because they learn to look for beauty. You know, so they'll come in and say, I learned about a new bird this week. With a story like the one I began with. They didn't even know there were birds. I had one patient say to me, I never knew birds sang. Okay. But the other part of the education is boundaries. And this is not just boundaries in the house and all that kind of stuff, that's very important, but boundaries make life predictable, which feels better than who knows what's going to happen next. So you have to explain it to them. So it doesn't just feel like you trying to control them, which is how they'll interpret it because that's what everybody tries to do. So part of it is, I want you to be able to know, if I get up tomorrow morning, breakfast is at this time, and you can count on it. It feels good to have things in our lives we can count on. So that's part of the reason for boundaries. The other reason is to teach them what they look like for relationships to be safe. And so you keep, you don't just do the boundary, you explain the boundary and how it's for her and for everybody. We do it this way because. So it will be meaningless to her unless you teach her the underlying reasons. It's also very critical for her to begin to develop a little sense of community. Many of these women have had no sense of family in their whole lives, or at least the only thing they knew about family was it was a bunch of people who hurt them. So you want to work on that in the sense of your residence. You also want to work on that in the churches that you're involved in and things like that. So all of that obviously needs to consider who she is and where she is and how she responds. But you do want her to have a taste of community before she leaves you. Keep in mind that healing, just like storytelling, is not linear. Now, I suspect there's a few people in this room who've been on diets, right? Well, what happens on a diet? You go on a diet, and then you go off the diet. And then you go on a diet, and then you go off the diet. It's very hard for any change to be linear for any human being. So when we're changing something, when we have a bad habit we're trying to stop, or a good habit we're trying to introduce, we usually don't do it 100% of the time. And then we have to go back to the beginning and start over again. So you need to keep that in mind too, because you're going to see this, and it's not because you're not doing it right. It's because this is what humans do when they change. All humans, even untrafficked ones. Their success obviously needs to be recognized and supported and announced, and their failures dealt with graciously as about part of the learning process, which is how you would teach a child. You don't want them to be full of shame and curl up in a ball somewhere because they didn't do it right. And so you want to use the opportunity to teach them this is what life is like for everybody. Your failure is not because of who you are. It's very important in terms of boundaries and things like that you also learn how to keep yourself emotionally regulated. When somebody in the room is with you and they're dysregulated, it's very easy to catch the disease, right? And then you have two emotionally dysregulated people. This is not a good outcome for treatment. And you want them, though you have to do it with them and perhaps for them initially, you eventually want them to take over a lot of that care for themselves in terms of their self-regulation, because she needs to find out that she's competent. I get upset and I do this and it actually works. One of the things I often say to my patients who would rather I do it all the time for them is, I am not your Xanax. Don't get confused. So let me just give you a few closing thoughts. It's grueling work. It's long-term work. Progress is in tiny steps, and it's easily swallowed up and disappears into the abyss of traumatic reactions all over again. One of the things I say to therapists who work in this area, and I will say to you, is this is little by little work. There is no other way to work with trauma. Part of the reason for that is if you try to go too fast, you'll overwhelm them. That's a replication of trauma. And part of it is this is how humans heal, little by little. Expect it. It's not glamorous. It is not sweeping in to rescue. There's no such thing. It's tiny bits. Hit the wall. Go backwards. Pick up. Dust off. Catch your breath. Do it again. That's what it looks like. But there's something I've learned about this kind of work. And that is this: God is ever and always working both sides. He did not just bring these people to me to help. He brought these people to me to transform me, which it has. The woman I described early on, who had the cigarettes put out on her feet, came to see me when I was 24 years old. At least my brain had stopped growing. I knew nothing about trauma. I have never been traumatized by anything. It was not a word. Nobody in my master's or my PhD ever used the word trauma or abuse. My first young client once said to me, "My father does weird things to me." I had no idea what she was talking about. What's weird? You know, I don't know what that means. Well, I found out. So she came, she sat in a chair, she curled up in a fetal position, and she came faithfully every week for 1 hour, and for 6 months, she said zero. Now, I went to graduate school to get a degree in psychology to talk to people and help them, and they would want to come and talk to me so I could help them, and they would tell me their story. Nobody ever mentioned in graduate school that I might have to sit with somebody who had no words. And how do you talk to somebody who won't talk? So it was interesting. The bottom line is I was her student for many years, and I literally said to her once she decided to speak to me, "I don't know anything about what's happened to you. There's no book I can read. So you're going to have to teach me, and I will do my darn best to figure out what would be helpful to you." So she did. And I found out later, when she had even more words, she said, "I didn't talk because I didn't think I was allowed." I said, "You came to see a psychologist?" She said, "You don't understand. I didn't know I was a human being. Human beings have conversations. I didn't know I was allowed." So if you let it, this work will certainly teach you about evil and darkness and atrocity and complex trauma. But oddly, it will also teach you about God. I mean, isn't that weird? You go down in the trenches of hell and you learn about God. But he came, he stepped into flesh, he lived, and he camped with us. That's pretty close to residential treatment, I'd say. He did it first. He made himself small, and he entered our world, and he stepped into a story that was not his own. He sat down, and he walked with, and he talked with, and he ate with, and he nurtured us little by little. That's exactly what you do. It's his work. And as you bend and bow and wait and learn to walk with those you serve, you are learning God's ways. He is shaping you to look like his son, because he's calling you to do the little by little that his son did with us. And so he's there making the women and you more like himself. You all heard of Amy Carmichael? Yes? No? For those of you who haven't, she died in 1951. She was a missionary in India, and she worked with prostituted Indian girls who were sold to the Hindu temples. She helped over 1,000 children before she died. And she wrote a book called Things as They Are. If you haven't read it, everybody in the room should read it. And it's about that work. I mean, she's written many things, many devotional things that will nurture your souls forever. So those are wonderful. But this is about this darkness and evil. And it was published, and the publisher would not ever republish it. Now you can get it in paperback, of course, through Amazon or something. But the publisher wouldn't republish it because it upset people. And the Indian government wasn't too happy with England. But she's written all kinds of poetry, and I like poetry, so she has one on Calvary. And there's a phrase in there that often just comes to mind, and when I think about the work that you do, it comes to mind. And it's this: "Ah, there are things done in the world today would root up faith but for Gethsemane." So, in Gethsemane, what did Jesus do? He called his people to watch with him. And that's the call of your life. You're watching with him. It's his work, not yours. He's in control of the timeline. He loves the woman in front of you more than you can ever imagine how to love her. It's his work, and he has said, watch with me. And sometimes he will show you what it looks like when a life is so redeemed it's just ridiculous and unspeakable and you can't believe it. And other times he will show you what it's like when somebody turns from him and no longer wants what he has to give. And sometimes he will show you what it's like when somebody hates him or is enraged with him. And sometimes he will show you what it's like for many of his sheep who walk with him and leave and walk with him and, you know, do the thing back and forth. All of those things are things that he has undergone. He is not asking you to do anything he has not done. Pursuit of him in all areas of your life, not just this work, but in here and in here and in your other relationships and everything else, is vital, or you will not bring his image to those you serve. And you're going to image something because we're image bearers. So if it's not him, it'll be the work. And you don't want to look like that. To work with trauma in the world today is to work with lies and darkness and evil. It's hell brought up below from below Earth's surface. And you and I cannot fight the litter of hell in others' lives unless we walk little by little, utterly dependent on the Spirit of God. It is a work that is a privilege to do. It is a work that is really hard to do. I mean, it's the task of serving as a reflection of the character of God so that the women you work with can have some idea who he really is rather than some twisted idea that they have now. It's a work that, if you let it, will take you to your knees. The woman that I talked about who was chained to the radiator, again, this is my first, you know, go-to complex case learning. And I tried to explain God's love for her. Stop talking to a woman who doesn't think she's a human being. And I got the splat thing. It was really apparent. Whatever I said went splat and bolt. And I remember today getting down on my knees beside my bed in my bedroom and saying to God, I quit. This isn't working. That woman needs to know how much you love her, and you're going to have to figure out how to show her because she's not getting it. So he did. He said, okay, not literally. He said, okay, you want her to know how much I love her? Then you get back in that room and you love her just like I love you. Which meant I had to depend utterly on him and learn vast amounts more of his love than I knew at that point. And so you walk into hell and you end up with more of Christ. God bless you. Thank you.